You're listening to the Global Capital Podcast, proudly sponsored by KFW.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm John Hay, the Corporates, Markets and Sustainability Editor.
And I'm Mike Turner, Corporate Bonds Editor.
Later on the show, we're going to be talking to Sarah Ainsworth, who, together with Atanas Dinov, constitute our financial institutions bond reporting team. And we're going to be talking to Sarah about a story she's written about the craze going on in that market at the moment for floating rate notes.
And we're going to be delving into the world of second lien mortgages in the RMBS market in the UK with Victoria Thieler speaking about George Smith's article.
But before that, Mike, you've been writing as usual about corporate bonds this week, and it's the beginning of the second quarter, isn't it? We've had Easter, which exactly coincided with the new quarter. What are people feeling about the market now?
Well, it's been a strange old first quarter in that it's been incredibly busy. We have had huge amounts of issuance, and that has continued really into the second quarter with a very busy short week.
So there was a public holiday in the UK on Monday and in some other countries. Not much time to get things done, but some issuers packed into the market and quite a varied bunch.
Yeah, we've had more than 4 billion of issuance this week between just Tuesday and Thursday because of the short week. Monday was a bank holiday. And to compare that with the first week of April in 2023, there was only 1 billion. And the first week of April in 2022, there was only 2 billion of euro issuance. And this is only speaking about euro issuance. The point being that people are really trying to raise as much money as they can. We've had trades for companies such as Vonovia, which is the German housing company, the sort of residential real estate company. We've had hybrid trades. We've had unrated trades for a company called Bell, which is a French foods company, that all gone very well and in many cases done much better than expected.
And that theme of things going better than expected has now been lasting quite a long time, hasn't it? Because at the end of the year, people were a bit puzzled why the market was so good. And then they didn't expect it to go on this year, did they?
No, that's right. It's this rally just keeps going on and on. It started in around November last year, maybe December last year, and people were telling me it'll all be over by Christmas. And then it's carried on into this year, even though investors know that there's plenty of deals coming. They don't have to rush to buy deals to, you know, get sort of end of year targets or anything like that. But it's continued apace, and the iTraxx main Europe indices, which monitors sort of the average spread of investment grade credit in Europe, has tightened by around 10 basis points since the start of the year, because investors are just chasing as many deals as they can.
Now, as we've talked about before, fundamentally, investors are lapping up bonds because they expect interest rates to be cut, and that will obviously give them a capital gain on those bonds, and it will also mean that they won't have any chances anymore to buy bonds at these rates. So there's a good reason for investors to buy bonds. Why are issuers so keen to issue though now? Is it just that they can sense the good market conditions, or is there more to it?
There's a degree of that. There's a degree of, you know, spreads are tight, so they want to take advantage. But the overarching looming concern in the market is what's going to happen in the back end of this year. So this was at the start of this year, I wrote quite extensively about how this is the sort of year of elections and the year of democracy around the world. More than half the world's population is going to the polls this year in one form or another. So it's really quite a huge potential for political risk. So far, that hasn't really played out, even with votes that have sort of gone against what would be market friendly. The European investment grade corporate bond market has nonetheless carried on and continued tightening, and deals have continued to go well. But at the end of this year, in November, there is a US presidential election, and that will have an impact globally. You know, regardless of what the outcome is, there's going to be an impact. And to avoid that, a lot of issuers have been pushing forward their funding programs. They've been coming earlier in the year and squeezing as much as they can into the first 3 months. And actually what we're hearing from bankers on the ground is that generally there's, you know, if you come in euros and you're a big issuer, you've got a large funding program that warrants you coming more than once a year, you do a deal and then you wait 3 months plus to give investors time to sort of recharge and not get overwhelmed by your debt and, you know, want to give you money again, basically. And what's happened is some issuers are now looking at cutting that timing so that they would rather cut short the time they give investors to get used to buying more of their debt than they would risk being in the back end of this year.
And you spoke to Vonovia, didn't you, that they explained their strategy?
Yes, I've been speaking to Fabian Lander, who's head of corporate financing at Vonovia. And he has explicitly said that because there is a lot of geopolitical risk in the second half of this year, that's why they've come in the first half. And, you know, for them, it's worked out really well. They did a debut sterling at the start of the year, which was a blowout by any metric you want to look at it. They came to Swiss francs, got a good deal away, and they came to euros this week for the first time this year in a trade that went better than expected. And they managed to price through their curve and tighten very aggressively from initial price thoughts to reoffer. So, you know, it's a strategy that is working out at the moment.
Now, banks notoriously always encourage issuers to come as soon as possible and warn them about that the market may get less good later, just to encourage activity. But with the political risk being firmly in the second half of the year, notably the US election, isn't that argument ringing a bit hollow? And is there an argument for issuers to say, no, you know, I'm going to wait. We've got all of May and June to come. You know, things could get even better.
There is that argument. But at the same time, I think if you wanted to try and catch this wave as best as you could, the time to come was in the first quarter, because that's when this rally was continuing and people couldn't work out exactly why, but they could just see it was happening. And we had very few deals that didn't go grand. So I think now the fact that it's continued into the start of April and the start of the second quarter is just ramping up the pressure on when's it all going to fall apart. Because it's all people, when I say people, I mean rarely is this the case, but bankers, issuers and investors are in agreement on this, that it could fall apart at any moment. And they've been saying that since December 2023. And there's a very definite end date when things will get more tricky, and that's in November. So the closer you get to that date, statistically, the more likely you are to come on a day that won't be a very good day to issue.
Interesting. And of course, the implication as well, if a lot of companies have been funding early, is that the market could go rather quiet, couldn't it?
For sure, and people are expecting that. On the banking side, we've sort of anecdotally had people tell us that they are looking to take longer than usual holidays in the summer. And on the investor side, on a sort of more serious market bent, there is a worry brewing that people are going to be, you know, snapping up these deals at the moment because everything's performing in secondary and things are going great and it's quite easy to make money just because of the amount of demand there is there. But as things go quieter and become a bit tougher, investors could end up stuck with a bunch of credit they don't really want and they can't really offload that is now looking quite expensive for them.
Yeah. So it's important not to get carried away by the enthusiasm of the bull run at the moment.
It is, but at the same time, you know, everyone is. So, yeah. You know, if you're an investor, it's got to be quite hard to talk to your end investors or talk to your boss and say, oh, we didn't buy this thing because everyone's so excited at the moment. So it'll probably be easy to explain why you and everyone else is in trouble rather than not do it now, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much, Mike.
So, John, you have continued your deep dive into what syndicate desks are becoming and what investment banking is becoming. What have you been looking at this week?
Well, yeah, it's broadened out a bit this week because as we've covered on the podcast and in articles in the last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of job losses of senior people on particularly syndicate desks, but in debt capital markets in general, as a result of the pressure on fees that's been there for the last couple of years, and also a sense that the job in some respects can be done by more junior people than was necessary in the past. And it's debatable, of course, whether that is correct and a wise decision. But at any rate, banks have been, cutting costs a bit in that area. Now, the implication of this for some of the people involved is that there's actually a secular change going on, and we're moving towards a more holistic approach to capital markets, in which banks would essentially put more product lines together into individual departments. Now, it's a very complex picture, of course, because the process of bringing bond or equity deals to market is a big process and involves lots of different functions. But generally, people are seeing a sort of trend towards things being brought together rather than separated out.
So this has been happening for a while in some of the more closely linked departments, things like loans and bonds, for example. It kind of makes sense, particularly because so often loans are given to companies in the hope of getting a bond mandate. So there's that sort of synergy there, and it's both debt related, right? But this feels like much more of a stretch when you're looking at debt and equity. Did you find when you were speaking to people that there is any sort of hesitation or reservations around how well that might work if you have DCM and ECM under one banner?
Yeah. So this is it is very interesting, and it's one of those things where banks are continually trying to shake up the puzzle pieces and rearrange them and fit them together in a different way to achieve a better result. And it's one could be doubtful whether they actually ever do manage to achieve real breakthroughs. However, they keep trying. And one of these ideas is how you deal with origination and how you cover companies. Now, one of the things about equity deals is that they have to be decided at the most strategic level. They're very important kind of company-changing deals. And really only the CEO and the board can decide whether to do one. Same as a merger and acquisition deal. And for that reason, those types of product are essentially marketed by banks to the CEO, the CFO, and the board. And you need a certain type of banker whose job is to concentrate on that and think about the strategic issues facing the company. So that's very different from what some of the other products that banks sell, such as debt funding, which tends to be delegated to the treasurer and a sort of special funding department. And the CEO doesn't have to know every time the company issues a bond and where it prices it. So it's fundamentally a different type of coverage. And banks have often tried to think about, well, can we sort of make that more efficient by getting a synergy out of it and either, having the same person do it or making it part of the same conversation or at least having one person scratch the other one's back. In other words, if we get an advantage on one side, using it to help win the mandate on the other. This is what banks are constantly trying to work out how to do better. And at the moment, I think, there are a variety of models being looked at.
But it's not just, machinations within banks that is affecting this. It's also how banks cover investors, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And so the banks obviously are covering both the corporate clients and the issuers on one side, but also the investors. And the investors, from one perspective, are even more important clients because it's the same ones day in, day out. You can do deals even in the debt market with a regular issuance. The issuers are not there every day, but every day you're selling to BlackRock and PIMCO and KKR and Apollo and all of these big fund houses. So how the banks cover them is super important. Now, we've had some people suggest that the big investment firms they've evolved in the way they want to engage with the markets, that they now think about investing in a thematic way. So, for example, they'll say, well, we want to invest in the green energy transition. And what they want to do is have a conversation with banks and say, show us what you've got to invest in that in all sorts of assets, equity, private loans, liquid credit, and so on. And What they find annoying, this argument is when they have to explain themselves five times to different people at the same bank. So some people are arguing that banks need to kind of listen to that and put together their capital markets operations in sort of more unified teams so that they can have the same people or at least the same teams talking to the investors across the pitch and make it a sort of more unified conversation.
Is the answer then to have sort of, you know, one team that doesn't necessarily know the deep intricacies of everything, but knows enough about everything that the bank does to be able to sort of guide investors and then go to these specialized teams within the banks? Is that the answer?
Well, you might think so. and it's interesting that, one implication could be exactly what you suggest, that there's a sort of strategic engagement and then you have the much more specialized product people to do the tactical stuff about actual new issues. I was quite surprised to find that people hadn't pursued that particularly. The chief investment officers, for example, at these big investment firms are covered by the banks in a sort of strategic way through the research side. So you'll have strategists and so on talk to them. But actually not all firms even have a chief investment officer or an overall approach. And really the most important interaction is through sales, essentially, and the actual trading and product interactions. Now, I found from the investors I spoke to that they were somewhat skeptical, to be honest, of this idea that banks could solve their problems by putting things together in one department. What they really want is to talk to the best people, and those are often very specialized product experts.
Does that mean we're not going to see banks put together ECM and DCM?
Yes, I think in terms of really merging those departments, I think that's unlikely because the products are just so different. If you think about as you pointed out earlier, between a bond and a loan, I mean they're different instruments and they have different considerations, but the risk is pretty similar. Whereas an equity is a completely different risk. The whole pace of the market's different. The deals are done much less often. Company will only do an IPO once in its lifetime or occasionally more. The level of interaction you need is different. So I think there's not really a lot of synergy banks can get by combining those. Also, if you think about the skills of pricing those instruments, it's unlikely anyone's really going to have the knowledge of those markets to be able to price both. However, what you can have is them together in the same sort of bigger division, which can be called global capital markets, as it is at some banks. And there, at least, you have them feeling like they're pulling in the same direction. And the capital allocation decision, which is a very important part of the picture, can be done in a unified way. So if the bank feels it needs to deploy capital to help a client with debt, that can also take into consideration whether they are going to make any business from them on the equity side. Now, if you've got those two bits of thinking going on completely separately, it's unlikely to be optimal. And if you bring that together, that can have a synergistic effect for the bank. But I mean, I think the overall message that I got from everybody I spoke to about this was what really matters is communication inside the banks. And, an investor said that you can really tell when you talk to the banks, the ones that where the left hand knows what the right hand is doing. Now, the left hand and right hand don't have to be in the same department, but you can tell when they know what each other are up to. And that's about having good systems internally for communication. And I think that could be a real differentiator between banks in the future.
Well, thanks, John. And in a moment, we'll be talking to Sarah Ainsworth about floating rate notes.
Hello, Sarah. Nice to have you on the podcast.
Hi, John. Nice to be here. And it's very nice to be back as well.
So, Sarah, there's been a big increase in floating rate note issuance among Europe's financial institutions. What's going on there?
Yes, there's been a really sharp rise in the volume and the number of transactions of floating rate notes that have been issued by banks this year. So a floating rate note, that means the coupon is variable and it will reset typically every 3 months, depending on where the prevailing interest rate is at a future point in time. And that's what's unusual is that that sort of product or format is not something you might expect when central banks are expected to cut policy rates later this year. So that's one of the things that, that makes it really interesting. So,
Shall I ask you a question there?
Sure.
Is that a good place to... Okay, so maybe we'll move on to those intricacies in a second. But what sort of deals have come this week that have showcased this?
Yeah, so we've had... it's been actually pretty subdued issuance this week because of the Easter holidays. So there haven't been a lot of deals. But of the ones that have arrived, there's been Danske Bank, the Danish bank. They've issued a 1 billion three-year FRN. Floating rate note, and also BMO, the Canadian bank, they've also issued a 1 billion three-year FRN as well. So I think there are only about four deals this week in unsecured FIG issuance, but half of them have been floaters. And bankers away from the deal said they went well, they both landed at flat to fair value, and they had, you know, decent enough order books. So it's been, but it's part of a theme that's been in place since the start of this year. But they've perhaps stood out a bit more this week because there haven't been as many other fixed deals that are priced.
How much FRN issuance has there been this year?
So the total volume raised now, so this is for euro-denominated unsecured, it's just under 20 billion. In 2024. So that's almost 50% higher now, actually, than the same period last year when it was about 13 billion. And then the number of transactions as well have been, I think we're up to 19 now this year. The same time last year, we'd done just 9 transactions.
So it is a real sort of meaningful shift towards this product, I guess, coming out.
Yeah, yeah. And the fact that they're, you know, if you were to do an internet search of what is a floating rate note, I think probably the first thing that would come up is say they are suited for investors who expect interest rates to rise.
Have you been looking at my internet searches?
I mean, the other odd thing is that obviously FRN suit banks, of course, because we're talking about bank issuers here, because banks live in a floating rate world. They want essentially all their debts to be floating rate. And back in the day, FRNs were a huge product that they used to issue a lot of. They've gone rather out of fashion because investors prefer the fixed ones. And banks can issue a fixed note and swap the proceeds to floating rate. And then for them, it's like they've issued a floating rate, but they can issue a fixed, which the investors want. So what we're having at the moment is the investors are suddenly deciding, well, actually, we want these floating rate notes after all. And why are they doing that just when rates are about to fall?
Yeah. So there are a couple of technical factors. So on the one hand, it's true that they will look at the policy interest rate path and the direction of rates. But two technical factors. One is the inverted yield curve. So that means that at the moment, if they're expecting for 3 month Euribor, what they can get by receiving the floating rate coupon is higher than if they were to go into a fixed rate and receive a 2 year fixed coupon. And that pickup at the moment is quite decent. It's about 100 basis points. So I think at the moment, let me just check, I think 3 month Euribor has been fixing in the region of 3.8%. Whereas if you do like a 2 year or a 3 year fixed interest rate swap and receive the coupon, it's more like 3%, 2.9, 3.1. The curve is quite flat there between 2 and 3 year. So yeah, it's almost 100 basis points pickup. So really, there's a pricing advantage for the investor, because in the short term, they think they can get a better coupon.
Well, is there a particular type of investor that is snapping these things up?
Yeah, so that's another interesting aspect, because traditionally, the buyers of FRNs have been bank treasuries. So, you know, what that would mean is that bank treasuries issue them, and then other bank treasuries will then buy them. But actually, it's been asset managers who have, in a shift in the order books, making up the allocations there, it's been asset managers who have been the overwhelming buyers of them. And that's really what's helped to drive demand. And the reason for that, it goes back to what I was talking about a couple of weeks ago, and I think you've also discussed on the podcast, is just all the cash, all the huge inflows that have gone into asset managers, money market and credit funds in particular, due to rising interest rates, due to corporates having more cash and so on. And they're awash with all this cash. And then they then deploy that in the front end, in the short end of the curve. So traditionally, money market funds would just go to, say, 12 months, but they've been sort of going a bit further out. Particularly credit funds are more comfortable going out to 2 years and 3 years as well.
So, Sarah, you said the asset managers are awash with cash. Where's that coming from and why?
So ultimately, it's because interest rates are so much higher than they were a couple of years ago. So that just means cash generally, there's a lot more liquidity in the market. And it's really, when you ask bankers, there's always two types of funds they identify: money market funds and short credit funds. So typically, in money market funds, that will include private investors who, you know, historically would just keep their money in deposit accounts, but they've been shifting their money into money market funds because it's more attractive. So in the past, when rates were really low or even negative, it didn't make a lot of sense to move money into money market funds because the pickup didn't look that great. But recently, with the rise in yields, there's been more mobility and people moving their cash across. And then another factor, as well as private investors, that again, bankers, DCM bankers, always seem to mention is corporates. And often they have a lot more money now from profits that they've made in the past year or so. It could just be coupons coming in that they have to reinvest as well.
I think as well, there's been a real lack of investment from corporates as well, sort of a bit of worry around spending new capex because of where interest rates are, which is giving them even more money.
Yeah, that's exactly what one DCM banker said. Yeah, that they're not necessarily, his words were, they're not necessarily rushing to use these funds for capex. Yeah, you're right. So and so in the short term, they need somewhere to park that money. So short credit funds has been the place of choice for them. And that all that money feeds into asset managers from money market and short credit funds. And the asset managers then manage it. And what's interesting is those asset managers tend to be a lot more agile than bank treasury desk in how they can then invest that cash. They don't have the same constraints that some bank treasuries have. So, for instance, some of the FRNs that have been issued, they've been bail-in FRNs, which means where they sort of stand in the credit stack. And bank treasuries might not be comfortable buying bail-ins, but asset managers are. Another interesting structure actually we've seen are callable FRNs. Danske's this week was a callable FRN. And I think there have been about four of them now in the past 6 weeks. And again, asset managers, they buy sort of callable products all the time, that they're comfortable with them, whereas bank treasuries less so. So yeah, the nature, the shift of buyers, that's also really helped as well.
I thought you had a really interesting quote as well from a FIG banker saying that credit investors are looking at corporate investment grade bonds and seeing that the pricing isn't really for them and finding there's much more value in financials. So I guess that's another layer of
yes,
money coming towards this.
Yeah, exactly. That was a FIG banker who said that, and he said he doesn't see that fundamentally changing in the near term. So on a valuation level as well, these FIG FRNs have looked attractive versus some other assets such as corporate investment grade sector, yeah.
So at the moment, we've got this peculiar yield curve with mm-hmm. the three-month Euribor being one of the highest rate points on the curve and it declining thereafter to mm-hmm. the 2 and 3 year swap rates and then beyond. So it's a very unusual situation. And obviously this means investors can get a great deal by buying FRNs that are priced over that short-term rate. And they're lapping it up if they like the yield. Is it really, therefore, that the banks are issuing these because there's this ample demand and they can get a good deal with these notes?
Yes. I mean, one of the technical factors that you highlighted is also that from the issuer's perspective is they look at the 3 month versus 6 month Euribor spread and where that is across the 2 year, 3 year point in the curve, which is the 2 year, 3 year is the maturity of these FRNs that are being issued. So based on that basis, the 3/6 is positive at the moment, which means that the 6 month is higher than the 3 month, roughly by about 8 basis points. So that what that means for the issuer, for the bank, is by selling an FRN that is linked to 3 month Euribor, they're saving around 8 basis points or so. As opposed to if it had been issued on a fixed rate basis and then asset swapped. So it's a reasonable saving for the issuer and something that they factor in. On the other side, I guess it doesn't look so attractive for the investor because you could say, well, they're losing out on this eight basis points that the issuer is gaining. But because demand is so strong, they're willing to give that up in order to buy the floating rate product because it suits their needs, their requirements so much.
So, Sarah, do you think there will be more FRNs then?
Well, DCM bankers certainly are hoping there will be. One global head of DCM at a European bank I spoke to on Thursday, he said at the moment, everyone is literally running around and trying to get issuers to do this trade. He's saying there's still good appetite there. There's still these huge inflows from asset managers. It doesn't suit every issuer, especially, the huge French banks, for example. They've got huge avenues of sourcing where they can raise money. But for DCM bankers, I think they're just trying to hunt out and encourage issuers to do these FRNs. So I think watch this space.
So, Victoria, thank you for joining us on the podcast again.
Thank you for having me.
So, Victoria, we're going to be talking about George Smith's story about second lien mortgage securitisation in the UK. Second lien mortgages being an extra mortgage after the first one on the same house. So obviously a riskier asset. There are a lot of them in the US and they've been securitised there for a long time, but we don't really hear about it much in the UK. So what's been happening this week?
Yeah, so you're right. It has been sort of a much bigger thing in the US and the UK. The whole market was essentially dead after the financial crisis. And then it sort of started coming back a little bit in 2017 with one issuer dominating the market for a while. And what we've seen, maybe not just this week, but sort of for the past 5 months, is that we had basically a deal a month in the UK, which is basically unheard of. And that even includes a new issuer called Equifinance, who tapped the market for the first time last week. So sort of that all encouraged George to have a closer look at the market and write a story about it this week.
And it didn't go great, did it, the Equifinance deal?
It did not. No, one banker that I spoke to used the word horrible, which is quite rare, even for bankers to say about other people's deals. Yeah, so what happened there is they came out with initial price thoughts at the range of 120 to 125 base points over SONIA, and the final pricing was 140 base points. And I know these numbers sound quite wide compared to other credit markets in general, but even in securitization pricing, 15 to 20 base points outside of your initial price or your initial guidance is generally perceived as just something going really wrong somewhere along the line, like sort of the banks or the issuer getting it wrong.
And Equifinance, it was their first ever securitization of any kind, wasn't it? The £259 million deal. Is there anything about the deal that would have made investors not like it, apart, that is, from the fact that it was a new issuer?
Yeah, so Equifinance, unlike some of the other more established issuers who have been doing these securitizations, tends to lend money to people who might have an adverse credit history. They might have higher loan-to-value ratios, and that was reflected in the portfolio. So according to the credit rating agency pre-sale report that George quotes in the piece, around a quarter of the pool had a loan-to-value ratio of over 80%. Around a quarter of the first borrowers were unemployed, around 9.4% were already at least a month in arrears. So quite a few elements to that collateral that would make investors view it as a bit more risky.
So they pushed back on the pricing, the deal widened. Is that a bad sign for the market for this product?
I don't think so. Let's say George and a few people that I spoke to don't think so. It seems to be fairly idiosyncratic to Equifinance, to the sort of fact that the asset class has a smaller investor base to begin with. Then we have this debut issuer. Then there is this riskier pool of collateral. We see on other RMBS deals and in the wider ABS market in general that there is still really good demand. A lot of deals end up being oversubscribed, especially on the mezzanine tranches. So it doesn't seem to be reflective of a weakening or softening in the wider market.
And after all, they still got their money, didn't they, the issuer? So they might have had to pay up a bit more, and the champagne on finishing the deal might have been drunk a bit more ruefully, but they got the financing they needed, essentially. So does that mean that the second lien mortgage market is now off to the races in securitization and there's going to be a lot more?
There might be a little more. It seems unlikely that sort of this pace of a deal a month for 5 months straight can be maintained, because there simply isn't enough collateral, sort of going back to this not being such a major thing in the UK. But it is increasing. So the sourcing of the underlying collateral has, the origination of the underlying collateral has increased with rising interest rates, because more people might have a good deal from a little while back on their mortgage, and now that they want to, don't know, buy a car or pay university fees for the kids or just have a down payment on a second home, it might be worth it for them to just take out a second smaller mortgage at a higher rate instead of giving up on their old good deal. So that in the long run might feed into a bit more securitization. It's likely, I think somebody estimated in the piece, that maybe a rate of one or two deals per year, so sort of a more steady flow of issuance, is good. And I would say, in a way, a deal like Equifinance, even if it doesn't sort of, yeah, if it doesn't end up being perfectly, and maybe they're just drinking Prosecco on their after deal party, it's still good for the market, because as you say, it got done. So investors are there to execute it. And a deal like this, if a market is maturing and growing, you need a variety of different deals to just get more investors looking at the asset class and to help develop a credit curve. So, yeah, I would say the outlook is fairly positive for this asset class.
Well, thank you very much, Victoria, for coming on, standing in for George. It's good to talk to you again, and we look forward to having you on the podcast again.
Thank you very much.